Welcome back to Series 4 of Listening to the Dead, as we look at forensic taphonomy, better known to you or I as body farms. Body farms were first set up in the 1980s in the US to study what happens to bodies post-mortem. These facilities serve as a resource for forensic anthropologists, researchers, as well as state and national law enforcement agencies who want to learn more about how bodies decompose over time in various environmental and climate conditions. It may sound a little bit macabre, but it's one of the most fascinating areas of forensic science today. It's also a huge subject, and so over the next two episodes, we'll be exploring this fascinating area of forensics, interviewing experts on both sides of the Atlantic. Starting today, joining Linda, Cass and I today is Dr. Daniel J. Westcott, Professor of Anthropology and Director of the Forensic Anthropology Center at Texas State University. This Texas State body farm, while being the largest in the world, remains one of only a dozen or so facilities around the world. Six of them are in the US, as well as others in Canada, Australia, and the Netherlands. And as part of this series, we'll be exploring why there aren't more of these facilities globally. Thank you for joining us, Danny. It's really great to have you.
Yes, welcome, Danny. And it's a big honor for me to be meeting an expert from the US in this field. So thank you so much for coming on board.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So Danny, I wonder if you could start by giving us a bit of a history of body farms. I said in my intro there that it began in the Knoxville facility in Tennessee in 1981. Where do you feel it all started?
So the first facility, like you mentioned, started in the 1980s with Dr. William Bass. And Dr. Bass, his recollections of this is that he, was working on a case and he was very far off on the identification or the time since death of the individual and realized that we really just don't have much information about how bodies decompose and how we estimate the time since death. And so he worked really hard to try to get this facility started, which in some ways is kind of interesting in the fact that then it becomes kind of historically something that anthropologists are associated with. But in reality, a lot of the research and stuff is not anthropological in that sense. So it became very multidisciplinary, and it's kind of progressed since then. And of course, you know, it kind of grew over time and then became a lot more famous with, you know, books like Patricia Cornwell's Body Farm, who used to go out there to the facility and get some ideas and inspiration on what to do. And, you know, the term body farm actually comes from, as far as I can know, it comes from her work. So then there wasn't really any facilities for quite some time after that. And then over time, there started to get what we realized is that there probably was a lot of regional effect and that we knew that climate had a big role in decomposition processes and, you know, other taphonomic events. And so there was a push to try to get more diversity as far as the environments that go. And so there have been slowly new facilities that have been added in different environments. There is maybe not as much as there should be, but there is collaboration between those facilities, which has been beneficial as well.
Why do you think it took so long for other sites to become established? As you said, it started in Knoxville, but it took something like 25 years or so for others to be set up. Did it take that long for everyone to recognize the value in the research?
Yeah, it was, a combination of things that happened. One is that, yeah, it took a while for, you know, law enforcement and others to become really kind of involved in this. But it also, you know, it's not an easy process to start a facility. It takes a lot of resources and it actually, you know, it takes a lot of support from a university administration. And that's one of the things that you see happen occasionally is that you get these facilities that want to start, but the administration doesn't really give it this full support and they'll fail.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, not only is it resources, but also just the fact that you have, you know, that you're dealing with, you know, dead bodies.
Yeah.
And so you have legal issues associated with that. You have, you know, ethical issues that are associated with the use of human remains. So all those things have to be kind of dealt with, but they also, like I said, you need an administration that will support that. And so from what I can tell, the facilities that have been successful so far are ones that the administration, the university administration, has seen the benefits of those facilities to their universities and have backed them, not just financially, but backed them in you know, providing legal counsel if necessary and anything else of that nature.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get to the ethical issue in a moment. Cass, I just wanted to come to you there. When did you first hear about body farms and the idea of using real life bodies? Because I know in the UK you were using animals.
Originally, it was through the Forensic Science Society. At one of the conferences, Pat Wiltshire, who I knew quite well, I think it was her speaking to her, and she had mentioned it about it. I know she did a documentary at one time with Bill Bass, where she went over to one of their facilities and spent some time there. So it was kind of like through her. I mean, when I was doing the job, yeah, we used anthropologists, archaeologists, entomologists to help us in cases. But to be honest, it was kind of rare, really. And I think that was because there wasn't an understanding amongst all CSIs about the good side of investigation and forensics that these different disciplines could bring to a sort of a buried body or a dump site, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So one of the things that, you know, I realized, you know, even in my career was when I first started, you know, in anthropology, pretty much the way the forensic anthropologist got involved was if there were skeletal remains, they would get all gathered up by law enforcement and they would bring them to the lab and they would say, you know, here they are. What can you tell us about it? And one of the things that they often asked us, you know, were details about, like, what might have happened at the scene. And it's like, well, I don't know. I've never been to the scene. So, you know, a lot of the push has actually been to, you know, get these experts that you want information about from at the scene. You know, I even tell, you know, when we do workshops and stuff, I always tell them, you got to think about what it is that you ultimately, your questions are going to be. And, you know, like if you need entomologists, you know, then, you know, arrange to have them out there to collect insects and stuff like that ahead of time. If you're going to need an excavation or you need an anthropologist, you know, to arrange that ahead of time. And I think that's made a big difference in the way that things go. And so, you know, I think when Bill Bass started out, it was pretty rare for him to go out to actually go to the scene. And so he was one of the early founders of kind of pushing for, if you really want us to help you, we need to be out. We need to see what's going on.
Yeah. So we sort of have this situation where law enforcement are asking these questions. They're saying they're finding skeletal remains in the ground, maybe just in a forest, could be in a, and they're asking their forensic scientists, how long has it been there? What is this cut mark? Is that post-mortem by an animal, or was it part of a trauma wound? So they're asking these questions. Now, before you had body farms, were the answers always going to be vague then, because we just didn't know enough?
Yes, they were always going to be vague. And to be perfectly honest, to this day, when you're talking about skeletonized remains, it becomes very difficult to determine how long they've been out there. But without being out at the scene, it becomes even more difficult to do. You know, I frequently tell law enforcement, you know, if you bring me a box of bones and ask me how old they are, I'm not going to be able to tell you.
So you have to see it in situ. You have to see it within the environment you found it, right?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So that was part of something we've covered previously, Cass, which is this idea that forensic science changed when forensic scientists were invited to the crime scene.
Yes, very much so. I mean, that's a very good example, because I can imagine that, and it's happened in time gone by over here, not even that long ago, that where officers think they've got a buried body, they get the shovels out, they dig a hole, the damaging bones that then makes it difficult to determine what was an injury inflicted at the time of death, or is this an injury after death? And as you say, they take them along to the anthropologist and say, well, can you tell me what these are? But it's too late by then, because you've contaminated the scene. Whereas if you have a buried body, if you get the anthropologist, the archaeologist, the entomologist out, you sit down together and you work out a strategy and a plan of how you're going to deal with this scene. Because you from the police side sometimes, oh, we want to get it out, we want to know who it is. And you think, well, without wishing to sound awful, it's dead, it's not going anywhere. We've got the time to get this right. And I think, I don't know, I mean, I imagine that's what happens certainly in America now. I think it's a lot better here. Whether it's up to the standard that it should be, I would say it isn't in some areas, only because CSIs and that over here don't have the training and the knowledge about what the different experts are capable of doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, your point there slightly reminds me of probably the most famous skeleton found in the last 100 years would be Richard III in a car park in Leicester. Yeah. And they stuck a shovel through his skull while trying to excavate it by mistake. So I can quite see care around excavating these things. So with that, Danny, I'm just trying to get the sort of timeline here. I'm getting a sense that, okay, law enforcement asked for these things. So ultimately this body farm was set up. Presumably location's really important. I noticed in the Knoxville one, it's in woods, but you know, bodies could be anywhere. You want to have as many different environments as possible where these body farms are located. I mean, what are the other factors? Are there geological factors one has to consider? You want different soils in which to bury these bodies in order to get the best results, most varied results.
Sure. So, you know, the other thing about the you know, kind of when we talk about the history of these facilities is that, you know, when Dr. Bass started it, you know, the one in Knoxville, it was really the main question was, you know, how long has the person been dead? And so, you know, that has expanded. And, you know, I mean, taphonomy is, you know, by definition is anything that happens to a body from the time it, or once living organism from the time it dies till it's discovered. Right. And so, There are a lot of other questions that can be asked. And so, you know, even like movement of the body, what is the original position of the body? What kind of scavengers would have come? How would they have affected the body? Can you get information from, you know, like stable isotopes that might give you an idea of if the person is local or were they traveling or things of that nature? And so all those are slightly affected by the environment. And if nothing else, even if it turns out that they're not, we need to know what things are affected by the environment and what things are not affected by the environment. And so, you know, like soils do make a difference in, you know, like how fast you decay, how much water is retained around that body, what kind of microbes are in that soil. You know, if you think about like, you know, ancient Egypt, I mean, it's full of mummies, and most of those mummies were not produced by people. They were produced because they were buried in sand, right? So, you know, all those kind of factors have an effect. And
Sorry, Danny, with that one, you're saying with Egypt that the embalming process wouldn't have preserved them. It's the fact that they were buried in sand? It's the fact that it's dry?
I'm not saying that. No, I'm sorry. There are intentional mummification processes that occurred, but there are also lots of mummies in desert areas that it's because of the fact that they're buried in sand. I mean, if you think about, you know, a body or any kind of a dead animal, They are a very nutrient but short-lived ecosystem, basically, right? So, and what's happening is that you have all these different microorganisms and, you know, larger organisms that are trying to extract as much nutrients from that individual's or that dead individual as possible before it's used up. And part of that is a drying process. And so the faster they dry up, the more likely they're going to be preserved. So all those things can have an effect on the decomposition process. And what they're doing is that you're always going to have decay, no matter what you do. It's just the time, the speed at which that decay happens, and then, you know, how fast that they dry out, for example, or preserved in some other way. They can also be preserved through moisture. Typically, just to give you an idea, if you take somebody and put them in a black bag, for example, and you place them on the ground surface, that bag is going to heat up and everything else, and all the bacteria in there are going to, you know, multiply very quickly. They're going to decompose very, very rapidly. If you take that same person, put them in a black bag and bury them, they are going to decompose slower than if you would have just buried them without a bag, because it maintains the moisture. It slows down the process a little bit. It's cooler underground. All those things are going to have a factor. The other thing with soil is, if you have a very acidic or very basic soil, it's going to have an effect on the decomposition. So there's lots of different things that are going on in these processes. And the extreme examples that would be, you know, very dry mummies that you see, or, you know, bog type, you know, where you have these like peat moss and peat bogs that are preserving bodies. But basically what in all of those cases, what's happening is that you are eliminating the microorganisms that really kind of initiate decay.
How fascinating.
And if you could slow that process down, then you slow down decay.
Yeah.
Danny, just out of curiosity, I mean, obviously, I'm sure you've dealt with lots of cases. We've had them over here where people have been murdered and then their bodies or body parts have been frozen and then dumped or buried at a later stage. Does that affect your analysis and conclusions a lot if that has happened? Or are there ways that you can... I know that pathologists can tell if a body's been frozen and you recover it quickly enough. There are methods by which you can tell if it's been in a freezer, but I just wondered if that changes, if a body's been in the ground, frozen, then in the ground for a long time.
Yeah, it's a good question. So we've actually, just because of the fact that, you know, we do research, and so a lot of times, you know, you have to, if you want to have enough bodies to do research and place them all out, for example, on one day, you're going to have to freeze some of them. So we've actually done some research on that. And there's kind of mixed results. I mean, there's an argument that you have some changes, but for example, what we have found is that it doesn't particularly mess with the microbiome that is within the body. That they seem to survive that okay. And so, at least here in Texas, it doesn't seem to have a huge effect on the decomposition rate, at least. Except for obviously the body is not going to decompose as fast when it's frozen. But once it thaws out, then it just kind of starts back at its normal rate. And so you would lose that time, obviously, that they were frozen. There's no way that you would be able to determine that.
Mm.
So, Danny, I'm curious, can you tell us a little bit about your facility, where it's located, and what the environment and climate is like there?
Yeah, so ours is located in the Texas Hill Country. So this is kind of an interesting area in the fact that we are right along an interstate, and so west of that interstate is Hill Country, which is kind of a hilly area, but also kind of a combination of, you know, sparse tree area, but also almost a deserty like, but with a little bit more moisture, humidity to it. And then east of that is actual coastal plains. So we get kind of a unique environment in the fact that we actually get moisture and stuff that comes up from the Gulf of Mexico. And then we also are far enough up that we get, the storms that come across east and west, or west to east in the United States. So we get this kind of interesting combination. Typically, with us, we have extremely hot, dry summers, and we will get temperatures that, I'm trying to think of the conversion here. For 100, we get 100 plus degree days for multiple days. So, 35 degree wow. or plus days, we'll get 90 of them a year sometimes. Sometimes you'll get, just day after day after day of these really hot, scorching temperatures. And then in the winter, we rarely have, days that drop below freezing. We get them, but it's pretty rare. So it's an overall pretty warm environment, but because of that Gulf moisture, we also get the humidity and stuff. So we're unique in that sense. So we're not like a dry desert, but we're also not like, we don't get nearly the rain that you would get, like, for example, in Tennessee.
So, Danny, would I be right in thinking that any conclusion a forensic scientist has to make about a body must take account of the local seasons? So what was the weather like over the period when the body was decomposing?
Yeah, so we find the seasonal effect has, the season in which the individual dies, it has a huge effect. And so actually, that's one of the things we're really interested in is, can we just get clues that give us information about the season of death? And that is a lot of it, because if you put somebody out that is in, when it's really hot summer, they're going to go through the early stages of decomposition very rapidly. But then you're going to have these, but it's also going to dry out. And so you're going to get this, basically skeleton with a very dry skin around it, where if you get somebody who decomposes in the spring, that's going to go through a much slower process, but you're going to get a lot more decomposition as far as the skin and other connective tissue. So they're going to actually skeletonize faster if they die, for example, in the spring than if they die in the summer.
God, that's absolutely fascinating. God, you could go on forever with these sort of various permutations of this, at what time of year somebody is buried and where they're left. So have you only done it in the natural environment that you find? You haven't imported any different soil into the facility to see what they're like in a less acidic soil or something like that?
We have not, no. That's one of the reasons for collaborating with other facilities and stuff. There is a lot of good research done on those kind of things, but most of those are done in the lab where you're controlling for everything except for soil acidity, for example. A taphonomy facility has always got the problem of that you can only control for so many things, right? So when we do a research project, maybe we will control for like what kind of clothing they have on, but we can't really, control for, is it going to rain this, a lot while they're out there or not, things of that nature. Where if you're looking at trying to isolate something like soil acidity, most of that's actually done better in a laboratory situation where you can actually, isolate everything and make everything exactly the same, except for, in this pan I have, a soil pH of this, and next one I have a soil pH of that.
Mm. How do you decide what experiments to do? You've got a limited, I presume, number of bodies you can have in the ground and donors who have given themselves to this. So you've got a limited number of experiments you can do at any one time. How do you make the decisions? What are the important ones to do?
Well, part of it's driven by what people are interested in doing at the time and how we can maximize the use of the donors. So, you know, one thing you'll find in science is that it kind of goes through periods where, you know, people are really interested in a certain topic for a while, and you get a lot of research that's done on that, and then it'll kind of switch. But for us, it's driven by the researchers that are coming. And we have researchers from all over the world that are coming. And so we, you know, evaluate what research would be most valuable to us and to the field at the time. But also, you know, I mean, we are limited in some ways with bodies, but you'd be surprised in that we actually turn down more people than we accept right now. So we could do more. The problem that you get with that then is the funding associated with it. It's not a cheap thing to happen.
How do you find the, with other facilities in America regarding data and information, are they good at sharing, or is it some units tend to keep things to themselves?
So it depends. What I've actually found is that the best projects as far as that go are ones that a lot of times for are outside researchers that actually go to all the facilities or a lot of the facilities and say, I want to do this in multiple places. So, for example, we're a part of a big microbiome project now that's looking at the bacteria and fungi and stuff like that are present associated with the body. And the researcher who's actually doing that is a microbiologist that doesn't have a facility at all. But she's doing the research because of the fact that, you know, she can have people place bodies at all the different facilities. We all collect the data the same way, and then she does the analysis. So in some ways, that's the ideal model. Unfortunately, what we haven't gotten to, which is something that I would like to see at some point, and that is that we all collect for at least some things, we collect the same data at the same times and things like that. And that becomes part of a larger database that researchers can access. But, you know, that's also requires a lot of funding to do. So I think we're getting closer to those kind of ideas but it takes time.
It makes me think again about the variables we were talking about. So, you know, we were talking about the different facilities have different environments, different geologies, and all of that will be really important in the different data you come up with. Presumably, you're also looking at different demographics in the donors. So different parts of America would have different demographic in terms of who their donors are. And maybe that has an important impact on the kind of research you can do. Is that right?
Yes and no. I mean, I would imagine that the demographics is not that different from one facility to the next. You are limited in the fact that, I mean, if you think about most forensic cases, most homicide cases, for example, most of the people that are actually dying in homicides are actually younger individuals. Who donates their bodies are older individuals, right? We do get some younger individuals, but most of our donors are older. As a matter of fact, our average donor age is 67 years old. So if there is something that age is affecting it, then you're going to see that in all the facilities.
Yeah. What about sort of the racial breakdown?
It might vary a little bit, but it's there again, it's not a huge factor. And as far as I can tell, there isn't anything that we've been able to tell that has anything to do with your ancestry or something like that, that if it really affects decomposition. As a matter of fact, if anything, what's going to affect decomposition is the microbiome that you carry in your gut already. and the variation that's associated with that. And so that even might be part of the regional effect is, you know, do different people in different, you know, people in different regions of the world have different microbiomes just because of, you know, what they're exposed to. And I think in the long run, what we're going to find is that that has a huge effect on the way that we decompose.
Oh, wow. That is absolutely fascinating. I can imagine Linda's already whirling away on a plot there.
This is pure gold. If you give me a few seconds, I'll just jot it down for my next plot. But can I ask you, what about other health factors, say like obesity? Do those change a person's microbiome? And can you tell me from a decomposed body whether they've had any health issues?
Well, yeah, I mean, anything that affects the bones, we'd be able to reproduce. So as far as other diseases go, it is possible that you could get some of that from these other types of studies. You know, I mean, obviously, if you have bacteria or infections or something of that nature, tuberculosis, for example, you know, if you find that in the soils and, you know, associated with the body, you'd be able to tell. We actually are looking at things like, the chemical structure of the soils, for example, to see if we can figure out if people were obese or something of that nature. As far as decomposition goes, it does probably have some effect. It depends on what stage of decomposition or how long that period has gone. So one of the things that we seem to see is that you get, in obese individuals, you get kind of an early, more rapid decomposition, but then they actually will slow down. And so in the later periods of decomposition, it's pretty hard to tell. But one of the things that's kind of interesting about that, for example, is that it is like fly larvae and other things don't really decompose fat very well. They don't tend to feed on fat like they would on muscle mass or other tissues. And so the decomposition of fat is more of it kind of melting away into the soil from the heat and, you know, breaking down that away. So you do get a difference in the decomposition pattern even a little bit, but that's actually something that's not very well studied yet.
When you somebody donates their body to your facility, how long would you keep them in the ground, and then what happens sort of afterwards after you've finished all your testing and research on that particular body?
Right. Okay, so for us, the how long the body's there is totally dependent on the research protocol that's going on. So, if, for example, you may have a buried body that you only, as far as the research goes, you know, maybe you're only looking at a 6-month period or something like that. Or you may have something, for example, we have a body that has been buried and we've continued to collect data on it since 2011. So for us, what we do is that, for example, like I just did a research project, was working on a research project where we were trying to come up with methods for locating clandestine burials. And so, you know, a lot of what we're looking at is like vegetative index and things of that nature. So using remote sensing to find bodies. Once we're done with those remains, then, a lot of times what we will do then is that those are the bodies that we'll use for a training process. So we will then, you know, have law enforcement come out. They have to find the bodies. They have to excavate the bodies and then recover them, right? Once they are done with that, then that body may go to a lab and it's processed down to a skeleton. So we remove all the excess soft tissue and any soils and things like that. And that's all usually done by undergraduate students who are learning their bone anatomy. And so they get to see a lot of human variation. They get to see, they get to see all these bones and have to figure out what they are and everything else. And then once they're done with that, then the skeletons come to our skeletal lab. And we actually have people from all over the world that come and do research on the skeletal remains themselves.
So, I mean, you get a lot out of a body. You get a lot of research out of a body, which is amazing. And you say you're turning bodies away. What is that, because you're full or because you only take certain sorts of bodies?
Well, so, you know, I mean, the thing is, it's like, for example, like right now with, you know, school not being in session, it being extremely, you know, we're going into an extremely hot period in here in Texas. And nobody really wants to come here. You know, no Europeans want to come here and do research in this temperature, right? So it slows down. And so as a result, you know, if we don't have a, you know, a purpose for that body, then there's no reason to accept them. That makes sense. So we go through periods where, you know, we will accept just about everybody that, you know, wants to donate, but other periods where it'll slow down. So for us, you know, what we have found is between about 60 and 70 bodies a year is what we actually typically use for research that we can utilize. If we had more researchers coming in, it's possible that we could, you know, up that. But then you run into the problem of, you know, you also have to process them down to a skeleton and stuff like that. And so the other problem is that, you know, it's financial. It costs a lot of money to do that. And so we are restricted somewhat in how many bodies we accept for that reason as well. So it's kind of a complex issue as far as that goes. We also, you know, we can legally get donors in really two different ways. One is that, which is what most of our donors are, and that's people that pre-registered while they are alive to be donated to our facility. And that's what we actually prefer. And so that kind of gets to part of the ethical issues, and that is that these people know what they're donating their bodies for, you know, and everything. The other way that we can is that the next of kin actually donates the remains. And those were probably much more picky about, you know, does that individual fit our protocol for a research project that's coming up?
So this idea of ethical concerns came up earlier. I really need to know, was it difficult to set up the facility in Texas for ethical reasons? Did people object to this idea of research with human bodies?
Right. So in Texas, there wasn't as much of a problem with that as there was with the location at which it would be. You know, which you always have the idea, you know, people think it's going to cause a lot of smell or something like that, which actually turns out that outdoor facilities don't. But in Texas, the biggest thing was, are they going to draw vultures? And so, for example, one of the proposed sites originally was right out by the airport, and that got shut down pretty quickly because people were worried that, you know, planes were going to hit vultures that were flying towards the bodies. So those are the kind of factors that affect us the most. But it also goes, you know, kind of the idea of that, you know, we are about as transparent as we possibly can be. And part of the reason for that is that I think it's very important for especially the local people to know what we do at the facility so that there isn't this, you know, kind of rumor mill going around. It's like, oh, what do they do out there? You know, things like that. We want them to be quite aware.
Well, we're happy to help with that, Danny.
Okay. Well, and that's the thing is, so podcasts like this and other, you know, other things, that's how we get that information out there. And I also, you know, in that sense, I do think that, you know, as a scientist, I think that it's important for the public to understand and know what scientists are doing. And so that's true with this as well. I mean, you're always going to have people that find it I don't know what the better term other than this, in their terms, disgusting that you would do research on undead people. But I think that, you know, they also see the benefit of it as well.
Just as a matter of interest, Danny, I read it was some years back, but it was an article about, you know, flies are attracted to dead bodies. And what it was a scientist was looking at, could you in somehow microchip in some way flies or insects if you're looking for a dead body in a vast area and see if that would take you to it. I don't know if you remember, and I don't know if it was a genuine article, but it certainly, I kind of read it. I thought, well, I could see the, like a dog can take you, you know, cadaver dogs. And I just wonder, had you heard of that at all?
I had not heard of that specifically. But yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, I mean, they're doing the same thing as a cadaver dog. They're actually using the signals that are given off by the bacteria associated with that dead body. And they, you know, they find the dead body very, very rapidly. So
what finds it from the greatest distance? I mean, what is the order of things that are attracted? So you get the small insects that are in the ground and then flies and then things that feed on flies. I mean, what order do things come to a body?
Things like blowflies, for example, are probably some of the earliest to get to the bodies. And like I said, they it appears that what's happening is they're actually being signaled by the bacteria. And there's a relationship between them. But then, yeah, you'll get the succession of scavengers that come. And as far as like flies go, you'll get, for example, then you'll get maggots that are flies that are coming, that their maggots are not really there to feed on the body. They're there to feed on the blowfly maggots. And then you'll get beetles that are attracted to the, you know, the maggots that are there as well. You'll get mice and stuff that are attracted to these maggots. You'll get beetles that are attracted to, you know, that decompose some of the like the skin and other things that are more difficult for, that are less attractive and aren't usually eaten by maggots. As far as scavengers go, they're, you know, bigger scavengers. They kind of, what we typically see is in Texas, we get lots of vultures. Part of that's because of the cattle industry that we have. And vultures will typically come about the time the body is starting to go into bloat. And so that's probably what they're smelling. And they are, but that gives them time to feed on it before it's just completely covered in maggots, because it's in the early stages of that. And then you get other animals that really are only going to feed on the body if they happen to accidentally come across it and it happens to be in the right stage of decomposition. You know, and, you know, for example, like you'll get mice or, you know, or even some large carnivores that'll chew on bones and they're interested in the red bone marrow. Or you'll get mice that are interested in the calcium and stuff from the bone, but they're not going to, the mice are, for example, not going to necessarily chew on that bone until it's started to dry out a little bit. So there's different stages and mostly it's associated with what kind of nutrients they are trying to get out of that body.
Yeah. I mean, I was just thinking that you were saying about the facility and being open, but presumably you've got to have it fenced to stop people wandering across it or, you know, being too nosy. But does that stop various animals that might otherwise scavenge getting to these bodies?
It stops probably, well, it stops some. It stops some that it probably slows down, you know, whether or not they would just happen across it. In our case, what we actually do is if we do not want, if we have research projects that we don't want scavengers involved in, we actually have to put a metal cage over the body anyhow, because there's no way of keeping out vultures, which are our primary scavenger. otherwise. So it probably does slow down, for example, the coyotes and things like that that might come in. However, most of these animals, fences don't really slow them down that much. They either go over or under it. And even then we get all kinds of animals in there that we don't expect. We have deer and stuff in the facility that I'm not quite sure how they get into the facility. But the one thing for us that it has prevented is wild hogs. And so, which for us is actually a good thing, because they will do a lot of damage and they're not safe to the researchers and stuff like that. So,
Just one other. I mean, over here, as you know, we haven't got any facilities, but obviously, before you opened up a facility where you can use dead humans, what did you actually find was the animal that is the closest to a human being in the way it decomposes for doing your tests on? And I mean, over here they use pigs a lot. Is that the right animal, or is there another animal that they could use that would give you more significant results?
So it really depends on what your question you're asking, right? And so if you're just looking at, you know, gross decomposition and things like that, then pigs are probably, you know, closest in body size and fat and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so in that sense, yes. Also probably, you know, the lack of really heavy fur and all that, you know, all those factors. But one of the things, if your questions are associated with the microbiome, for example, then pigs don't work at all.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I mean, and this is why I was saying there's probably, you know, big regional variation. When we've done some research out here looking at microbiome on pigs, what the researchers have found is that not only can they tell the difference between pigs and humans, but they can tell what farm the pig actually came from. So, you know, that all those factors are going to have an effect. And so that is one of the reasons that, you know, humans doing research on humans is necessary, because depending on your research questions, you may not be able to have, a proxy for them at all.
With the training and the people who come to the facility to be trained, I mean, could you give some examples of the types of people who come to the facility? You've got law enforcement, obviously. Have you got others who come and look at what you're doing?
One of the things that has also evolved over time that we've realized with these facilities is that they are a fantastic place to train people that deal with, you know, with death, basically. And so we do everything from, you know, training on how to excavate bodies. We even have a mass grave project. How do you excavate a mass grave versus a single body burial? You know, what kind of questions are you asking, and how does that affect the training? For our police, for example, a lot of that is actually, you know, being exposed to dead bodies, you know, where their first exposure is not on their first, you know, real scene, right? Where they're the only ones there. To give them an idea of, you know, the decomposition process and, you know, when they go out on a crime scene, they have some kind of idea of what they're looking at and what could have caused the differences in the scene and stuff. We also do fire investigation training, for example. And one of the things that with a lot of our training, what it is, and the fire investigation, I think, is the greatest example of that, is that when you have a structure fire, for example, where there is a death associated with that, there are multiple people that are coming to investigate that scene that a lot of times don't understand what the other person's doing. So, for example, the firefighters, they have their mission and they have certain things they want to find, they want to do, and they don't really care that there's a dead body over there, or that if they toss all this, you know, debris over there, it's going to mess up your interpretation. Same thing if you're going there to investigate the body. You don't really care why the fire started, or the fact that I, you know, am, you know, or that something I'm doing might injure me, you know, stuff like, not that you don't care, but you may not know that where the fire department would know that. So a lot of the training is to give people a real life scenario that they can actually investigate themselves as well. So for example, when we do a fire investigation, we'll set up a scenario. We will photograph it. Matter of fact, we now are doing 3D reconstructions. So you can literally walk through the scene before the fire starts. You can watch the fire happen. And then you can see what it is that your interpretation of that fire was, right? So if we bring the fire department out there after it's burned and everybody goes through the process, then they can watch what happened. But it also teaches them to understand what those other investigators are doing and how they might help with each other. So, for example, one of the things that we've actually found is that the movement of the body might actually give you clues as to where the fire originated from because of the way that the muscles shrink and stuff. And so by having all these people working together and going through this process, you get a much better, you know, it's like we started talking about earlier, and that is that you get all these different people with different expertise at the scene that are thoughtful about how do we interpret the entire scene, not how do I do my job.
That's a good, really good point, I think, as well. Cause obviously, your firemen are similar to ours over here at times in the way they extinguish fires and chuck everything out in the yard. But there we go. The point is there, I think, as well, is that what you say is getting people sitting down and talking to each other and understanding each other's disciplines. Because I think if you don't have an understanding as a crime scene investigator or manager of what these different people can do and able to control a meeting and who needs to go first or do this or do that, or how can we work together, then you're starting off on the wrong foot. And I mean, sometimes you'll get, you know, people, they'll argue with each other. Well, I need to do this or I need to do that. And you say, well, hang on a minute. What is the priority there? Are we going to lose this evidence if we do that first? What is the better evidence? So, and I just used to find that didn't happen a lot unless you, I mean, I, there was no real training, even when I went into the CSI side of things, in what you do, entomologists do, those people. It was mostly through the society and finding out for myself. And if something happened, you know, the senior investigator would ask me, oh, what about so? I said, well, I don't know, Governor, but I know someone who does, which was great, you know, and brought that knowledge to the scene.
Yeah, so that's one of the things that, you know, like you had mentioned earlier, was, you know, the person's dead. And so unless there's something that where you think that somebody's going to come and like take the body or something like that, some kind of, a, you know, you have time to think about it. And so that's why, you know, when we are doing this, I always tell, you know, when we're doing workshops is, you know, you need to approach this like a scientist would a project. And that is what are your research questions? Or what do you want to get from this? What are the important things that you're going to need to build your case? And let's get everybody in the room and talk about what is the best process to do this. And like you said, who needs to go out there and collect first, you know, and who needs, once you find it, then do you need to, you know, stop and have other people come in and collect their evidence before you move on to the next step? Because in a lot of cases, by you doing your step, you just destroyed information that they might possibly have, right? Or you make it to where it's very hard to defend because, you know, a defense lawyer can easily say, well, you know, was this the right process? You know, did you screw this up? And, you know, and if you have to say, well, it wasn't the right process, it, you know, and it could have been contaminated, well, that makes it hard to prosecute that case.
Yeah. I mean, do you manage to recreate crime scenes then, specifically tailor-made to what a police force wants?
We can to some extent, okay? We have had cases where there are competing, you know, hypotheses about what happened. And sometimes what we can do is reconstruct those scenes and get an idea of which one is more likely or something of that nature. Just to give you one example, we have... Well, I'll give you two examples. One of them, there was body that was found with what looked like cut marks in the axilla or the armpits, and then right around the groin. And what one of the ideas of this was is that this was a drug related thing, and they actually like laid this guy out and cut his arteries and let him bleed to death. Well, the alternative to that was it was just because that's the way vultures feed. And so we actually were able to lay bodies out and do both and, you know, and look at the other things in that scene and what is more likely. In this case, what we showed was that it was much more likely that scene represented vulture scavenging than anything else.
Yeah.
Another example, this is actually more for a defense lawyer, there was this argument that, well, this guy, you know, what they were arguing was this guy had killed his wife and then he wrapped her up in carpet and he drove her to a scene and then he dumped her body, but then he disposed of the carpet someplace else. And they found that carpet. And one of the investigators had said, well, we know that the body was in here because it smelled a decomp. Well, the body was only in there for a short period of time and, you know, all that stuff. So we actually, you know, wrapped bodies in there and then, you know, literally had people that knew had no idea whether the body had been in there or not come and smell the carpet and, you know, test it like that. We didn't actually have the time before the trial to do like truly VOC testing or anything like that. But, you know, or you can do it like run cadaver dogs and, you know, and see, can they actually tell whether the, you know, there was a body in it and things like that. So there are things like that that we can actually test that are directly related to a scene or a case.
I think it's a good thing that because it's, I mean, I don't know how you find it over there, but having been a detective, my view and the way I looked at things totally changed when I got into the forensic side of things and looking at all the different possibilities. And the scientists' approaches are very much objective and challenging themselves, whereas detectives are if I say, I know he did it and I'm going to find everything to prove he did it. So those examples are there. And that's the thing. And I mean, like when you said with the carpet, you can get one detective go, can you smell that? And you'll get the row of them go, oh, yeah, you have to smell that. You know?
Right. Well, and so, you know, in some ways, this is the other advantage that I have in the fact that I work for a university and the fact that in some ways I don't really have any, you know, it doesn't really matter to me whether they can prove their case or not. That makes sense? I mean, it does to me.
Yeah, no, I get it. Yeah.
Member
yeah.
of society, but, you know, but what I'm saying is that, you know, as a result, I think it's just as important that the research that we do can exonerate people if that's what's important. You know, I mean, I don't think that the research should be totally focused on how do we convict somebody of a crime or something like that. Mm-hmm. The idea is what can we learn from that crime scene and does that, you know, help you or hurt you? I don't know. Right. You know, so a lot of times, you know, I'm asked to do stuff and, you know, on cases, it's like, I literally cannot help you with that. And as a matter of fact, sometimes with defense lawyers, what I'm actually asked is, could the other person do this? Right. Cause we'll get like medical examiners that will give the time of death, you know, like, it was, you know, 2 years, 3 months, and 12 days ago. It's like, there's no way.
2 seconds.
The science behind that to back that up, you know?
I mean, there used to be, it's got pretty good over here. I think in general, a pathologist will say to you, you know, like you said, well, from the time you last saw them to the time you found them.
Well, Danny, look, thank you so much for your time. There is literally so much we could talk about here. We could keep going for hours. I know that. And we've all got so much more to learn about this. So thank you so much for your time. It tees up beautifully our next episode, where we'll focus on the UK side of things, where we do not yet have a body farm facility. But watch this space. We're going to talk to Professor Anna Williams about, are we going to get one in the UK? So Danny, thank you. Cass, Linda, thank you very much. And we'll pick this up in the next episode.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
All right, cheers.
If you want to find out more about the Texas State Forensic Anthropology Center, check out the links to their websites and social media in the episode notes. And also, don't forget to check out Linda's new book, The Scene of the Crime, starring a team of forensic scientists, tailor-made for you Listening to the Dead fans. And that's out now, available in hardback, ebook, and audiobook. And remember that if you're a Spotify subscriber, you can access the audiobook as part of your Spotify subscription. And if you want to know more about Linda and our guests on this podcast, then check out her website at lindalaplan.com.